Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
Welcome, everyone, to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I am your co-host, Kimberly Corbin.
And I am Kara Robinson Chamberlain, and we are so glad to be here talking to you. And we just have so much wisdom to impart and humor and plenty of dark humor. And we are honored to be part of your journey.
Thank you so much for tuning in. I know it's a little weird when there's a new podcast that drops, and I feel like everyone thinks about starting their own podcast, but for Kara and I, we just thought about it for a real long time, and we're glad to finally have it come to fruition because, gosh, I guess we've known each other now for almost 2 years. Almost?
Yeah. I mean, it feels like forever, but also, yeah, in the best way. Yeah. And I think it's just right time, right place, right? Like, it has to be the right people, the right place, the right time for things to come together. And we've had this idea, I mean, for at least a year, we've been working on this off and on.
So many of our ideologies and just outlook on how to best support survivors and their families align in so many ways that are beyond just the normal conversations that you hear, you know, maybe it's on a subway or between friends over coffee or something. These are the big conversations that you might not be ready to have, but you want to hear. And we just want to do our best to represent the entire survivor community because we know that in many cases, it looks very different from us. It feels very different. There are all different walks of life, and we are only going to be able to share, you know, our very small little piece of who we are and what we know. But the idea is to bring other survivors with their expertise in so that in some way, shape, or form, you can connect to each person that we have on for different reasons.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that we have tried to be very intentional about as well in scheduling guests and who we want to talk to is that we have people who, like Kim said, are different than us. They have different stories. They look different than us. They sound different than us. Because the ultimate goal for us is to help people feel seen in these stories and kind of have some of the conversations that, like Kim said, maybe you haven't heard. They're a little different. I kind of think of your average true crime podcast as like a 101 level, and we're like 201, 301. So we're like next level. We are two people who have absolutely lived true crime. We have done the media gamut. We have many different experiences. Some of the things that are going to set us apart and help us to kind of elevate our conversations are that we do both have experience in the justice system. We have media trained experience. We have victims advocacy experience in addition to our experience as being victims and survivors as well. And we both have done pretty large scale media type things. So we're media trained, trauma informed. And so that's some of the things that are going to make our conversations a little bit different. And some of the things to expect are conversations that kind of push the envelope and make you think a little outside of the box.
And I think that is important to point out, Kara, is that we are regarded as experts in our field, not because we have large platforms or followers, but because we have put in the time and the work to educate ourselves, to pursue those lines of education. We've had careers in the criminal justice field. We are certified victim advocates, and we are not going to leave you hanging without resources and the ability to help yourselves as well. Those are really big pieces that I have found are missing from a lot of the true crime content that is put out there. Another piece is consent. Let's talk about consent because it's not just between two adults that are, you know, going to play mattress mambo or something. Consent is everything from how your stuff is used digitally to did you maintain ownership over your story? Did these content creators ask to include you? Are you being compensated for the way that they are profiting off of your story? And Kara and I can both tell you, we have been victims of that experience. The true crime industry in general has not always been all that kind to us. And you're going to hear a lot from our guests about the different ways that they have dealt with true crime. Some are positive, some are negative. But we want you to understand that while you're listening to this, be thinking about the way that you consume these things as well, because we're all learning together. And that's the whole purpose of this, is not to shame you or make you feel bad about the things that, you know, you want to sit on a Friday night with your glass of wine and watch Oxygen or whatever the true crime documentary of the day is. It's not to do that, but it's to think deeper and to remember there are real people at the center of every single one of these stories and their voices are the ones that we want to elevate here.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I really am trying to be intentional about is encouraging people to make decisions on their own. So we want to empower you, give you the information to make the best decisions. So if you like consuming true crime, if it's something that you enjoy, well, we want to give you the tools to pick the true crime media that empowers survivors and that gives back, which is another thing that we're pretty passionate about. So we try to make sure that the people that come on, our guests, we try to make sure that they are supported through the process. But we also want to push you guys back to empower you to empower these guests with calls to action. So when you're consuming this content and there's not a call to action that's pushing people back to support the guest or to something productive, it's kind of icky. You know, it's kind of what a lot of people call just trauma porn. And so we're trying to avoid that. We're telling stories with a purpose, which is to increase advocacy, to raise money for a cause, to help you learn tools to heal. There will be calls to action on every single episode, and it will push you back to our guests or a cause that is meaningful to them. So it just helps you to further support that person, because consent and compensation is very important when you talk about sharing these stories. But also, we want to support these people in further ways, because ultimately in this survival situation, it's about community. And this is how you build community, because these are the people that are going to link arms with you when you're having a bad day. And they're going to say, this shit sucks. And this is what I do to get through it. And you know, like when you have a bad day, you need people who understand what you're going through. And so we want you guys to be part of our community. We want you to be part of this greater community that includes every single one of our guests, and just to have this beautiful support system for you, for us, for our guests. And we truly mean that. This is something that we're passionate about, helping others to help themselves.
Yes. We want this to be interactive. We want you to get involved. We want you to feel like you are taking back your own power, because all of us have been through some kind of trauma in our lives. It doesn't have to be a kidnapping or a sex assault or domestic violence, but there is some sort of trauma that we have all experienced, and there are good and bad ways to work through that, but you have to find out which one suits you, which one is best for you. We're going to give you the tools. We're going to give you the guidebook to true crime, and the rest is going to be up to you. So we love interacting. We love hearing back from you. You know, the best ways that you're going to be able to support us here and what we're doing is by liking, rating, reviewing, sharing, interacting with content. But we're always going to point you back to the survivors and the families that we have on and how they can better educate all of us. So we are excited to get started and really make this an amazing community, like Kara said.
Yes. Thank you to every single one of you who is here. We just are looking forward to this journey. And like Kim said, always, you know, report back to us. We both manage our own social media. So you, it's fine.
Yay. It is
fine. We're doing a great job. It's fine. Kim's mental health and her ability to handle things is directly correlated to the number of puppies that she has at any given moment. So whether or not she has puppies remains to be seen, whether or not her husband allows her to foster more dogs. But just, you know, you could just gauge our mental health by, you know, you'll learn all the little tips and tricks. And mine will be like how much I show up on social media will be how well I'm doing. Because if I'm there a lot, it means that I am dissociating a lot. So anyway, we are real people. You will learn all of our fun quirks. And like Kim said, you know, none of us get through this thing called life without some sort of emotional damage.
We're going to call it levity and the ability to laugh at ourselves. So we hope you stick around for that. Understand that Kara and I are going on 2 years of understanding each other's dark humor. So if you hear something and you're like, oh my gosh, did they just say that? Yes. Yes, we did. We're willing to put it on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
I think you're going to learn a lot more about us as we work our way through especially this first season. And you're going to hear a lot more about what happened to Kara and I. But we'd like to kick off this first episode by going into a deeper dive on our stories. And we're going to start with Kara's, as it happened first chronologically. So Kara, as our guest today, tell us to your comfort level about your experience as a survivor.
Yeah, absolutely. So I like to, in this kind of format, kind of give a flyover. I call it, you know, it's like the airplane view of my story. If you want to hear more about it, there's a ton of places you can find it. And I'll go into that at the end. So when I was 15 years old, I lived in Lexington, South Carolina. It's a kind of rural to suburban area, not terribly heavily populated, kind of low crime general area. I didn't really know anyone who had been a victim of a crime that I could think of. And I wasn't necessarily naive. I'm an only child. I was pretty mature for my age, was kind of the caregiver and the mom of my friend group, more or less. And so I had a boyfriend, I had a best friend. I was always at one or the other's house. And so summer, June, and I had spent the night at my friend's house, and we woke up the next morning trying to figure out kind of what are we going to do for the day. We called our friend who had a house on the lake and decided to go to her house for the day. My friend called her mom, said, okay, what do we need to do before we leave? And her mom asked that we water the flowers before we left. And so my friend wanted to take a shower, and I volunteered to water the flowers while she did that. And so that was kind of the decision for me that changed the course of my life, volunteering to water these plants for her outside. So she goes to the shower. I go outside. I'm still in kind of like my pajamas, which is like a t-shirt and kind of like cheerleading type shorts. And I'm outside watering the plants. I'm, like I said, 15, getting ready to get my license, looking at cars. And so I notice a Trans Am when it drives by on the way out of the neighborhood. And it comes back into the neighborhood and pulls into the driveway. And so I didn't really think anything suspicious. We like to think that we have like this intuition sometimes. And I think ultimately I'm a fairly optimistic person. And so when this car pulls into the driveway, a man gets out. He doesn't look scary or creepy or like he's nefarious by any means. I'm in a neighborhood. There are, you know, homes all around me. And he gets out. He is a average looking white male, not shifty. Doesn't look like he's on drugs or anything like that. He's wearing like a button down. He's wearing a baseball cap. It's not pulled down super low. He's wearing jeans. He walks directly over to me. He has kind of like a binder in his hands. And he said, hey, I'm out here today and I'm distributing these pamphlets, flyers, magazines, you know, something like that. I kind of interchange those words. If you hear me tell the story, I kind of interchange those because it's kind of like all the same thing. I can't remember exactly what word he said. But he said, I'm out here distributing these and I was going to leave them with your parents. Is your mom or dad home? And I said, well, this is my friend's house. And he said, okay, well, what about her mom or dad? Are they home? And I said, well, this is her mom's house. Her mom's not here. So I'm like volunteering information, like 101, don't do this. But again, I had this false sense of security because,
Right.
And also there's just like this false sense of security. You don't think this kind of stuff happens in a neighborhood, right? Where you're safe. And so I said, no, her mom's not home. And he said, okay, well, I'll just leave them with you and you can leave them inside for her when she gets home. And during the whole interchange, During the whole exchange, he remained like a respectable distance away from me. He wasn't in my, you know, personal space bubble until he reached in to hand me these magazines. So he has the binder in his left hand and he's kind of pulled them out and he's handing them to me with his left hand. And he reaches around to the right side of my neck with his right arm and puts a gun to the side of my neck. I immediately know it's a gun. I never saw it, but I somehow knew it was a gun. Maybe it was the metal. I'm not sure, but I felt it pressed to the side of my neck. And he says, come with me. And I kind of went, stop. And he goes, no, you're going to come with me. And so he has his arm kind of around my neck and walks me to the driver's side of the car and opens the driver's door. It's a two-door car, opens the driver's door, puts the seat forward and says, get in. I look in the back seat. There's a large plastic container back there. And I say, where am I supposed to go? He said, get in the container. So I get in the container. This is, you know, like a large plastic container, like you would store extra clothes or your Christmas decorations in your attic. And so I get in the container, kind of curl up in the fetal position, and I'm on my back getting the container. He puts the top kind of loosely on and puts the seat back, gets in the car and backs out of the driveway. The whole exchange lasts less than 2 minutes from the time the car pulls into the driveway to the time he's backing out. And I immediately have the intuition of what this person wants. I don't know him. I don't know his name. I know very little about him, but I know that he is an adult man who has kidnapped a teenage girl and that there is probably only one thing he wants. And so I immediately know that there will be a sexual assault. I know that's coming. And I know, again, where did one of the questions I get a lot is, where did all of this information come from that you have about what to do? And I don't know, honestly. It wasn't like my parents said, if this ever happens, this is what to do or expect. It was strictly my survival instinct and it was intuition for me. I knew that he would want me to be scared. And spoiler alert, I am a very, very stubborn person. And I kind of just decided I was not going to be scared, that I kind of shut that off. And now that is not to say that I had like this amazing strength of will to do that, but that was kind of just my survival instinct. And so dissociated, shut down emotions, and started being very factual and very analytical about my approach to the situation. And so I also realized that in addition to not letting him control my emotions, I did not want him to control when and if I was able to leave his captivity. And I wanted to have information so that I could identify him when I escaped, because there was never a question in my mind that I was going to escape. It was going to be when he became complacent and I would gain his trust, let him think that I was an easy victim, that I wasn't going to fight back, so that he would become complacent and I could escape. So I start paying attention to the turns we're taking, trying to figure out where we're going. I feel the car merge onto the interstate and kind of abandon that plan. So I'm memorizing things like the songs that are on the radio. There was a serial number on the inside of the container. I'm memorizing that number. I'm just kind of trying to shove information into my brain, any and everything that I can for the next 18 hours. And so we drive, he drives with me in the container for about 10 or 15 minutes before pulling over kind of off the side of the road, at which point he restrained me, put handcuffs and a ball gag and leg restraints on me, asked me to scream as loud as I could, and then said, okay. And then he put the container lid all the way on. Drives for a couple more minutes before he stops the car and lifts the container with me inside out of the car, drags it, kind of carries it a short way, and then drags it over what I can tell is a threshold into his apartment, where I spent the next 18 hours. And I'm gonna take a breath here, because you might have questions.
When you were told to scream, mm-hmm. what did that feel like in your body?
That's like,
was there a release or a moment where the panic actually can have an outlet?
No, not yet. One of my coping mechanisms was definitely to shut off my emotions And so the kind of the colloquial term that we all use for this is dissociation. And so mine was kind of an emotional dissociation, so like a separation of my emotions, but also a bodily dissociation. So separating from the things that were going on in my body. So I actually did not feel much panic the entire time that I was with my captor. There was very little panic response. It was just kind of going through the motions and a very out of body experience.
Yeah, that one came to my mind. And for everyone listening, Kara and I have talked about our stories with each other ad nauseum. I mean, the ins and outs of all of it. So most of these questions that a lot of you may have, Kara and I have already discussed before, but that is something that we want to leave open. If you do have questions, please keep them written down. You guys can write in, whatever it may be. But some of the others that I think come up that you kind of breezed over. When you're talking about being out in the yard, describe that street and the fact that there weren't really, it wasn't populated with a ton of people right. that are screaming that someone's being kidnapped.
Right. It's your average kind of suburban street. This was kind of the neighborhood where there's like one road in, right? So this house was on the road into the neighborhood. And then there's kind of like other branches, kind of like a tree shaped neighborhood, right? As opposed to like a circular with separate outlets. So we're on the main road and there's, you know, this is like middle income kind of neighborhood subdivision of the early 2000s. And houses outside, the neighbor, the immediate neighbor who we knew very well, the immediate next door neighbor, was actually outside at the time. He was in his backyard doing yard work. He actually saw me get into the car with this man. So it just looked like I was getting into the car with someone I knew who had his arm around my shoulder. I wasn't kicking and screaming. So he did not raise any alarms. So when law enforcement was called and responded and they talked to the neighbors, he was like, oh, yeah, I saw her get into the car. So I was actually initially listed as a runaway because, you know, kids, 15-year-olds just do this kind of stuff, even though, you know, I'd left my purse. I didn't have my shoes. I had no at-risk signs that I was a runaway. I had a boyfriend who didn't know where I was and didn't know anyone who had this kind of car, but actually was listed as a runaway. So very much, again, you know, it's this sense of safety and the fact that stranger kidnappings aren't actually that common. So, and kind of a point of contention for me also is just this idea that a missing 15-year-old would be a runaway and not a missing person. It's like, it's still a child right. that is in danger regardless. Right. So,
well, and I know that we'll, along the way, dissect a little bit more about that and what could have possibly been different if they had talked about Start By Believing, or just the fact that everyone is telling these officers, no, she is not a runaway. She right. did not run away. Listen to them the first time that they say that. So
right.
as you go on, tell us about what happened next.
Yeah, so I am taken in the container into the apartment and my captor kind of leaves me there for a minute, comes back, takes the lid off. He's changed clothes into just kind of like a t-shirt and some shorts, like casual clothes. And he says, I'm going to take the gag out, but you have to promise that you're not going to scream or make any noise. And remember that I will always have a gun or some type of weapon with me at all times. And so I kind of nodded my head. Yeah, I agreed to that. And so he took it out. And he took the handcuffs and the leg restraint off and he takes me to, this is my first view of the apartment that I'm in. Small apartment, one bedroom, one bath, maybe 600 square foot apartment. And I notice instantly there are kind of like cages with animals like lizards and fish and a guinea pig and a parrot and lots of animals. The apartment's very cluttered, just kind of with stuff. And so he says, you know, we're going to go into the next room. We go into the bedroom. He sits down on the bed, tells me to sit down, and he gets out like a legal pad, yellow legal pad. And he starts asking me questions and writing down the answers. So this is like his fact gathering mission. And he doesn't realize that I'm also kind of going to be doing the same thing. So He's asking me, what is your name? What's your friend's name? Whose house you are at? Where do you live? What's your mom's name? What's your dad's name? What are their addresses? Are you a virgin? Have you had your period? When was your last period? Just like so many questions that were just kind of fact gathering questions and writing down the answers. And I mean, I was truthful with him, but I always thought that was weird. And they never found any of this information. They never found that notepad, which I think is interesting.
But they found other ones, didn't they?
They found some handwritten notes. Yeah.
That's bizarre.
We will circle back to that one.
We're going to circle back to that one. Yes.
We'll circle back to it. So I was with my captor for 18 hours. And the way that my memory works, what I've learned is a lot of people have similar memories. I have more of a visual memory. So I see snapshots and I don't necessarily know where they go in time. So as opposed to like a rolling movie of every single thing that happened, I have snapshots of things that happened. So I was with my captor for 18 hours and I have snapshots of me sitting on the couch with him while he is smoking a pipe of weed and talking to him about he was in the Navy. So here's one of my fact gathering things. And so I'm kind of getting information about his life. I have a snapshot of, you know, him making me watch the news or to see if anybody missed me. I have a snapshot of, strangely, I was sexually assaulted. I don't even know how many times, honestly. I don't have snapshots of that. That is all like
really
completely. Yeah. Isn't that strange?
I mean,
I don't have any.
You were dissociating so yeah. thoroughly, and there's no mm-hmm. information really that you're gathering from that. It's, I guess in right. my mind, that kind of makes sense, but I see it like that's kind of how I remember it too. And I remember peripheral things,
yeah.
but not, yeah, I get that.
Memory is so, like trauma brain is so interesting to me. So, yeah, I have all of these snapshots and I have like a snapshot of him making me watch pornography. I remember that happened, but I don't remember any of the other details. I have a snapshot, and this one is like one of the more detailed of when he is like, oh, I'm going to make dinner. You have to eat something. You're going to have to eat something while you're here. And I was like, okay, but I can't eat anything right now. So what can I do for you? And he's like, you can sweep the kitchen. So I'm like sweeping the kitchen and then I get close to his refrigerator and I can see the refrigerator. So that's like another snapshot with the magnets mm-hmm. that have like his dentist and his doctor. And so there's some more information that I'm gathering, right?
So was this the same, like as you're recounting this after the mm-hmm. fact, are you recounting it in those snapshots as well? Has that always been your memory or has that changed over time?
It's changed over time. And I definitely... I had to go back and read the incident report and read my statement because I remembered every single detail. But I would say that was once it converted to long-term memory from short-term memory, that's where the change mm-hmm. happened. So it's fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Which is why they do those statements fairly quickly because you want to mm-hmm. hit it before that conversion from short to long-term memory because you kind of tend to lose some details there. So I have another snapshot of when I was in the bathroom and I noticed things in the bathroom that led me to believe that a woman lived there as well. So I saw a hairbrush with long red hair. I saw the three things that I specifically noted were tampons, hairspray, and a hairbrush with long red hair. So I was like, okay, someone else lives here. It's a woman with long red hair. And then kind of the strongest, and I would say the most impactful snapshot that I have, and the most traumatic, honestly, of all the things, the thing that was the most traumatic was when I got put back into the container. Not any of these other things, but he said he had to make a phone call. I'm going to put you back in the container. And I'm pretty sure he put the gag back in my mouth. And put the lid on the container. And I just remember laying there and going, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And that was the like the real moment of panic for me. I was like, I'm going to die in this box. I'm going to suffocate because I couldn't breathe through my nose, like apparently in panic. And I just felt like I was suffocating. And so that is honestly where I have the most trauma storage and trauma effects is from that moment of being in the container. So he comes back into the room. And this was also the only time that I truly saw like malice and anger from him, which is very strange. But the rest of the time he was there, it sounds terrible for me to say. And every time I say it, I feel uncomfortable, but he was friendly towards me. Like,
oh yes.
Yeah.
It's yes. Like, okay, I get that. That's like a discomfort. Yeah. You don't want to describe someone in a way that sheds a positive light when they're doing this to you, but
right.
That's a descriptor.
It's so strange. And when I've done interviews, not so much like on podcasts or things that I've done recently, like in the last couple of years, but before that, when I was younger and before I knew about, you know, like proper victim representation in media, and I was just kind of doing interviews mm-hmm. because people asked, people would be like, but he was mean, right? And I was like, not really. Like, I don't know how to tell you that. So it feels weird still for me to say, because I was made to feel uncomfortable about saying it. And it's like, how do you say that someone was nice to you while you were being repeatedly sexually assaulted?
Right.
But yeah, it was so strange. There wasn't a lot of malice in him.
It speaks to the self-control that these offenders and these predators have, because they can right. act in that matter. They can mask it the same way that you're dissociating and whatnot. They are able to mask that in public at all times. And so you know that the forethought and the intent that goes in prior to them ever committing that crime is there. They could make the choice not to do it. They choose to. And that's evidenced by how controlled and even keel he is that entire experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, right? And it's how these people like go under the radar, right? Or off the radar. Like, this is how they do this. So he comes back into the room. He's very angry. This is the one time that I truly see like anger and kind of the monster behind the mask. And and I think it's because he, at his core, he needed me to be quiet because he needed to continue to hide what was happening. I found out later the phone call that he had to make was to his wife. There was a woman that lived in the apartment. She was not there. It was his wife. And that was the phone call he had to make. So I couldn't make noise because I would blow his cover. And so I'm hyperventilating, having an actual panic attack, quite obviously making noise because I'm sobbing at this point. And he comes back in and I've scared him. And so that's when the mask kind of slips and he, you know, says, what's the problem here? I don't understand. Why are you making noise? And I'm like, you know, I'm hyperventilating. I can't breathe. And he said, okay, I'll take the gag out and I will leave the lid off. But you have to remember, you know, I have a gun, I have a weapon, etc. And that I will use it if I have to. I nodded that I understood. And so he took the gag out. And, you know, it's like this compromise. It's one of the things you'll hear us talk about in one of our episodes. It's this appeasement where it's like a mutual co-regulation of the nervous system. And so he takes the gag out, kind of puts a blanket over the top and leaves like an air hole and then leaves the room, continues his phone call. So comes back in, gives me a Valium at that point. It's another snapshot, a Valium with a purple Gatorade that I still cannot drink. I cannot drink a purple Gatorade. Makes me want to throw up. And yeah, right. Trauma brain. And so he gives me that. And then honestly, the next snapshot that I have is waking up the next morning. Like, so I had been restrained for bed. I don't remember that part. I don't necessarily have a snapshot of that. I just remember waking up the next morning. I have handcuffs on my wrists, like fur-lined handcuffs. And there's it's called a quick link. It's a carabiner type clasp, but instead of a open close clasp, it has a screw that closes it. And so I have a quick link around the middle of the handcuffs. It is tied to a rope that's tied, kind of goes behind the bed and is tied to the frame of the bed. And then I have a leg restraint, like a BDSM style leg restraint on my right leg that is tied with a carabiner clip and a rope to the foot of the bed. And my captor is asleep next to me. It's early morning. So there's like this early morning light filtering through the window, which is right next to the bed. And I know that this is the time. This is when he's the most complacent, the least on guard. And this is the time for me to escape. And so first thing that I have to do is get my hands free. Can't slip either one of my wrists out of the handcuffs at that point. So I have to unscrew the quick link. I end up having to do that with my teeth. I can't do it with my hands. Unscrew it, slide the handcuffs out of the quick link, reach my hand down my leg to the leg restraint. unclip that and slide out of the bed. I'm wearing like a t-shirt of my captors, and I honestly can't remember if I had on underwear or not. I don't know. I go to the living room, find my shorts that I had worn there, put my shorts on, go to the front door, which is more or less barricaded. There's the container that I was transported in. There's like a coat closet that opens and closes. That's kind of like hanging open with like stuff hanging out of it, and then a door with a deadbolt. And so I have to kind of move all of this in one fell swoop, because if I'm going to make noise, it has to be all at once, because my captor is literally on the other side of a wall, sleeping in a bed next to a window that looks out at this front door. So I, to this day, don't know how I moved all of the things at once, but somehow moved everything, threw the door open, and ran. Had full-on tunnel vision running across the parking lot of this apartment complex. I see a car driving through the parking lot, run out in front of it, flag it down. At this point, I had been able to squeeze one of my hands out of the handcuffs. So I'm waving down the car, mm-hmm. You know, handcuffs dangling, run to the driver's side. There's two men inside, middle-aged and a teenager. And I said, my name's Kara Robinson. I was kidnapped and I escaped from that apartment, and kind of turned around and pointed to it. And I was like, remember that apartment? And they said, okay, get in the car. And they said, what do you want us to do? And I said, take me to law enforcement. And so that's what they did. So kind of the next snapshot I have is being in the region, which for people who don't know, it's kind of like a substation, not usually really staffed, especially in kind of like the early morning hours.
Yeah,
so, I go into the region, like running through by myself. And because the men didn't come in with me, and I hear a voice say, ma'am, excuse me, ma'am, can I help you? And go to where the voice is. There's a corporal in there, and he starts taking my incident report, tell him everything that happened. And he starts to try to look me up in NCIC, National Combined Index for Crime. And it's where they list like stolen guns, cars, person, and missing persons. And I vividly remember the dink.
The keyboard. Yeah.
Dink. Like three times he's dink. And he's like, I'm having some trouble finding you. And it was just this moment of like, does he not believe me? Like it at that time, it felt like I wasn't believed briefly. Now, as time has gone on, I have come to understand it wasn't that he didn't believe me. It was a sense of disbelief, because he was sitting there finishing up reports, and in runs a teenager that says she was kidnapped from, you know, by a stranger and handcuffs dangling. It's a very unbelievable situation. So he eventually finds me, calls my mom.
It had not been on the news or anything yet.
No,
really.
No.
To a point where it would have saturated that everyone would have known yet.
Right. And I think nowadays, like, that would have been a perfect Amber Alert situation. We had a description of the person. We had a description of the car. When did an Amber Alert happen? Do you know the year?
2000s.
I think it had just kind of started, but maybe it wasn't national.
For Colorado, it started in April of 2002.
Yeah. So like, this is 2002 is really when it started to kind of amp up. And this is 2002. So you're looking at national cases like Elizabeth Smart. Like that's the biggest one where, you know, there's just a lot of publicity around missing persons and stuff like that around that time. And so that kind of increases the national scope of Amber Alert. But again, I felt like I wasn't believed for a time. And eventually he finds me in NCIC. He notifies my mom, calls my mom, notifies an investigator who responds. Investigator comes. He's the person that removes the handcuffs. And he says, the guys that brought you in don't know the apartment. And do you think you'd be up to trying to identify it? At this point, I have so much information crammed into my brain. I'm like, I cannot possibly contain one more thing, but I'll try. You know, apartment complex, they literally all look the same. If you've never been in it before, I know it's a bottom left apartment. That's all I have. So get in the car with the investigator, go back to the apartment complex. As expected, cannot identify it. whatsoever, but we do see a man, kind of like a maintenance person, on the golf cart riding around. I tell him all of the information I know. It's a man. This is what he looks like. There's a woman with red hair. This is what the inside of the apartment looks like. These are the animals that he has. This is the car that he drives. And he kind of immediately knows the apartment. So we go back to the region. My mom's there. She takes me to get a sexual assault kit done. While I'm waiting for the sexual assault exam at the hospital, they bring me a photo lineup. They have used all of the information that I gave them, the car, the doctor, the dentist. And I think at that point, they hadn't got a warrant for the information from the apartment complex. So I think they kind of cross-referenced all of that and were able to identify my captor. His name was Richard Markovonitz. He was completely off the record, you know, under the radar and unknown at that point. So I immediately identify him. He is not in his apartment. He is on the run for a few days before essentially his sister turns him in, sets him up kind of. And that happened in Sarasota, Florida. He was supposed to be meeting her in Florida. Police kind of staked it out. He went on the run in his car. Fairly short police chase ensues. They deploy stop sticks, his car wrecks, and they send in a canine. And at some point between the canine biting his arm and letting go and rebiting his leg, he shoots himself. So that's his end. Not the end of the story, because when they go into his apartment, searching his apartment, they find a locked footlocker with some kind of suspicious things, some newspaper clippings of murders from Virginia, some handwritten notes. And they immediately notify the Silva Lisk Task Force in Virginia, who responds. And over the course of the next few months, he is positively linked to the murders of three girls in Virginia, Sophia Silva, Kristen, and Katie Lisk, who were murdered in 1996 and 1997. So he was never a suspect for those murders. And it's kind of my belief that he was responsible for more that we don't know. And I hope that we will know one day. It's kind of one of my passion projects, you know, between all the other millions of things that I'm doing, trying to uncover other things that he may be responsible for. But yeah, so I said I was going to give a brief version, but I couldn't. I couldn't do that.
That is, are you kidding me? That was brief.
That was so brief. I condensed 24 hours plus 2 extra days and then a few months after into less than an hour. So go me.
I want to also point out what Kara just did in delving into so many pieces of the event of her victimization itself is not necessarily what we're going to ask every guest to do. We don't want to focus on the crime so much, but for Kara and I, it's really important that you understand these ins and outs because we're going to relate back to them and talk about them quite a bit. And there's a lot of different pieces to what we experienced and how we can relate to other survivors. So if you at least have our backgrounds and understand a lot of those, you'll understand the connections and the jumps that we make with some of the other guests. I want to focus on from the time that you are safe, quote unquote, and back with your family. What was that like? Because I know that your experience is different from what a media portrayal may look like. Tell us about that.
A little bit. So I felt fine. I was not having PTSD. I was not having nightmares.
I'm fine.
I'm fine. I felt fine. I felt normal. To that point, the only perception I had of how people responded to trauma was what I had seen on TV, and I was not having any of those symptoms, so I must be fine. And so I wanted people to treat me normal. I wanted people to treat July 28th Kara the same as they had treated July 21st Kara. I didn't want them to treat me any differently. And so one of the things that I learned is by asking people to do that, it kind of shut them down. It didn't allow them to process it. But that wasn't necessarily my job, but it's another thing that I've become passionate about is like the impact of secondary victims and allowing them the space to process and not realizing until almost 20 years later that I had actually kind of not given other people the space to process.
Right. Which isn't something that should be your burden to bear as a victim or as a 15-year-old.
Absolutely not. Like it wasn't my responsibility, but it's just something kind of to have in the back of your mind if you are a secondary victim or if you love someone who has been a victim of a traumatic experience that, you know, secondary trauma is still trauma. So yeah, I wanted to be treated normal. I wanted things to go back to normal. And that just, you know, obviously wasn't the case. But as much as I could, I tried to, I say pretend, but I wasn't really pretending. I wasn't affected by my trauma. I told myself this story that my trauma didn't affect me because I was not having flashbacks or PTSD or any of these major symptoms for, you know, 15 years. I told myself, my trauma doesn't affect me. I'm fine. And so that became the case. And that became kind of the story I told myself for 15 years until the birth of my children, when I realized I had continued utilizing dissociation and suppressing my emotions as a stress coping mechanism and how unhealthy that was and how that had kept me in a perpetual state of fight or flight and how I was just really angry all the time. The one emotion that I felt consistently was just really, really pissed off. People like to say, so how did you get over that? And like the truth of the matter is I just stopped doing it. Like that's not, I understand it's not that easy for a lot of people, but for me at that point in time, therapy was not something that was accessible for me. So I kind of had to fumble my way through it. And I was like, oh, you're suppressing all of your emotions. Anytime I would feel a feeling, I would literally be like, stop, 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 stop. And like, take a couple deep breaths and then not feel it. And so I just stopped doing that. It wasn't overnight. It's gotten easier. And it's been 5 years of kind of working through that. And I have feelings now and it's disgustingly inconvenient, but I guess I'm healthier.
We don't like to feel the, but we do because it's best.
It's for the best. You know, one of the other cool things that we kind of alluded to earlier is that I became a not just media trained through sharing my story, but I also became a trauma informed and justice educated person. I don't know, but I went on to work in law enforcement. And that was done through fostering relationships of people that I met through my victimization. So most namely, the sheriff of the agency from the jurisdiction that I was recovered in. So I was kidnapped from one jurisdiction, recovered in the neighboring jurisdiction. So the sheriff of Richland County, South Carolina, he was the sheriff then. He's still the sheriff because he's that awesome. So 20 plus years of being the sheriff, Sheriff Leon Lott, he was the sheriff then. He never treated me a single day as a victim. He treated me as a survivor. There was no poor you or this is what could have happened to you. It was just, wow. You have a lot to be proud of. You should be very proud of yourself. If you ever want a job, there's one here for you. And it was 15 plus years of him treating me that way. The summer after my kidnapping, he called my mom and said, would Kara like to come and work at the sheriff's department administratively? And that became my career. I worked in an administrative capacity, high school through college. I worked at the sheriff's department until I graduated college, at which point I became sworn law enforcement officer. Over the years, I worked administratively in the DNA and drug lab. I worked with the cold case unit. I worked with youth arbitration, which is like when kids get in trouble in school, kind of preventing them from going into the justice system. When I became sworn, I worked as a school resource officer. And then I worked in investigations, investigating child abuse and sexual assault cases. And the final thing that I did before I left law enforcement to have children is I worked as a victims advocate. So law enforcement victims advocate. And that kind of has all helped me in my journey to doing what I do now. And the whole time, you know, I did want to also address what Kim said, which is that you will not hear most of our guests go into this level of detail, but this is what Kim and I do. We do keynote speeches. And so we're used to sharing this. This has always been part of our journey that we've shared openly. And so for me, I have always felt like I was able to share in the way that I do so that people could feel seen. And so that people could learn something from my story. And so that's something I've taken forward into this stage of my life, which is advocacy in a public arena through media and then through keynote speeches, where I do a lot of work with law enforcement specifically is kind of my highest number of keynote speeches and just the importance of how to treat someone like a survivor as opposed to a victim. Yes. So it's how I ended up where I am today.
And there's never going to be enough education and focus on that because we are constantly bombarded with images or portrayals of victimization and never all the things that it takes to build back up after that. When you talk about investigating sex assaults and crimes against kids, those are some of the highest rates of burnout.
Mm-hmm.
Hardest ones to investigate and to eventually bring to a prosecutor and be able to build a solid case, just the nature of those crimes.
Mm-hmm.
What did you feel like when you're going through those? I mean, I ask because in my mind, when I was doing victim advocacy at the police department, I'd have in mind that like, ooh, I went through something similar, but I never disclosed that. I'm not talking about my victimization. That's not what you're there for. But there is a level of empathy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way that you regard someone in that scenario is just different. Is that what you found?
For sure. So one of the things that I experienced through my work, and I'm kind of just realizing this as I'm thinking about it, through the years that I worked.
We love spontaneous revelations.
I literally just had one. I found that through the years that I worked at the sheriff's department, a lot of people there treated me like a victim. But it was different than what you expected. So this is what it looked like. I wanted to go work on the road. I wanted to respond to calls. I find psychology, and I was a psychology major in college. So I find these things, I find psychology of humans very interesting. And so for me, working on the road, learning to talk to people, that was what I wanted to do. But people protected me from that. I would put in my letter to escalate up the chain of command, my intent to go to the road, and it would be stopped. So people would protect me because they didn't want me to get hurt. And they also ultimately didn't want to be the one that was responsible for getting, quote, the sheriff's girl hurt, right? They didn't want to be the one that was like, you know,
yep,
their behind was being held over the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to investigations, I was given the cases that were the throwaway cases, essentially. And here's what I mean by that. I was given the cases that were an open and closed case. So you have your mandated reporters. So the Department of Health, if the Department of Health receives someone under the age of consent that comes in requesting birth control or prenatal care or an abortion or any of these things, they are mandated reporters. So my first arrest was actually as an investigator, and it was a mandated report. It was a 14-year-old who came in, wanted birth control, said that she was sexually active. Turns out they went and did a swab. And I don't even think she had a full, I honestly don't think she had a full exam done. I think that it was just kind of swab for documentation kind of thing. Comes back with a CODIS DNA hit for an offender. It's a 22-year-old, you know, someone has lived a life of crime. And so right. I made an arrest. But this is a case that most people would receive. They would go, okay, documentation purposes only, open, close. But I didn't work them that way. I worked every single case as if it was an assault. Another one that really sticks in my mind is there was a teenage girl, maybe 14 or 15, lied to her parents about where she was going to be. You know, I'm going to be spending the night at so-and-so's house, really went to a party. While she was there, she sexually assaulted. I can't remember if it was just alcohol induced, if she was drugged, doesn't matter. She sexually assaulted while she's there. I was still in training and investigations at this point. And so, again, I have this story of like these two sheriffs, and one was terrible and one was great. I have these two training officers where one was fantastic and gave me words that I took forward into training other law enforcement officers. And then I have this other guy who says, hey, so this case, you're just going to have to close the case. And I said, what? I was like, but she was sexually assaulted. He's like, yeah, but she's already proved to be an unreliable victim because she lied to her parents about where she was. And so you're not going to be able to prosecute this case. Now, in South Carolina, the law states that all you need to prosecute is the word of the victim that a sexual assault occurred. However, mm-hmm. we all know that's not enough to convict. You know, I think notoriously, one of the things I have to explain to people is why you really, if you want to heal and you want to move forward, you really can't hang your healing hat on a conviction, because these cases are notoriously difficult to prosecute. Because at the end of the day, even if you have DNA, it comes down to a he said, she said kind of situation of whether there was consent. You know, we like to think in this SVU world that there would be physical trauma, or, but that is just not the case most of the time. There's right. just not evidence that supports a sexual assault. And I would say 90% of the cases that I saw, there was not a physical overwhelming amount of evidence that would prove that it did happen. So at the end of the day, it comes down to he said, she said, and if you have a victim that has already proven she's a liar, this our solicitor was not of the mind that she wanted to put someone through the rigmarole of a trial if mm-hmm. there was not going to be a conviction. So she would not necessarily want us to make an arrest.
Right.
There was not a good chance of a successful prosecution. So that's the other case that kind of sticks in my mind. And I didn't do that. I didn't listen to what he said. I called her in, I got a statement, but at the end of the day, I lasted less than 2 years in that role. I think that is, I think the average is about 2 years of prosecution of sexual assault cases and people that work in that arena. I lasted less than 2 years because at the end of the day, I would get 10 new cases every single day. And out of those 10, I would maybe close two or three because they were documentation only. And I would have maybe one every other day that there might be some chance of prosecution. And then I would have seven or eight cases that would just stay open. And so I felt like I was pushing a boulder up a hill. I felt like I was not doing anything. And that's a very helpless feeling. You're like, what am I doing? I'm the kind of person that likes to check off boxes and like I have a to-do list and I check them off and I move on to the next thing. And I wasn't. I was like, I'm drowning here. And so mm-hmm. ultimately, that was what led to me making the transition from investigations to victims advocacy, where I felt like I actually was making a difference because I was giving people tools and I was actually helping people to transition out of this victimhood into, you know, moving on with their life and becoming a survivor.
Yes. Yes. And I think that that's in part, whereas you may have had that role in smaller parts throughout your time at the sheriff's office, this is one that you have then carried into your personal life, into your work, your volunteering, everything else. This is how you operate now. And it is by imparting those tools and empowering other people to make those choices for themselves. You're not going to tell them how they should do it necessarily. You can provide a guide, but it's about empowering them and pointing them in the right direction. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to do it yourself. And that's tough because that's not a case that you just close out. I mean, if you think about it in terms of hours, are our cases ever really closed, done and closed out? Because no, we will live with this for the rest of our lives. And there will always be things that pop up where we're like, oh, that's weird and directly related to X, Y, Z. Spicy memories. You're never going to completely close out what happened to you as a survivor. And I think that compounded on what you're talking about is exactly why so many people burn out. And I know that they try to rotate out of that position to alleviate that from happening. But I don't think I could do it. And the time that I was there and assisted on cases like that it's a lot. It's really, really tough.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I can say, I think that there are faults in our justice system, but also now as a mother of boys, now I will preface this by saying, I don't believe that false accusations are prevalent. However, if there ever came a case against one of my sons, I would want them to have fair due process. Like I would want them to be proven guilty without a shadow of a doubt, right? And that's just really, really difficult. So it's balancing the rights of the victim versus the rights of the alleged offender. And it's tricky. I don't know that there's a solution.
And we're going to grapple with that too, because as much as we are completely 100% in the corner of survivors, there are always going to be these nuanced conversations that you're going to encounter out in the wild or around your dinner table that you'd probably like to be better informed, or I'd even say armed with the facts and the ability to make those decisions for yourselves. Something Kara and I will always come back to is that we start by believing. Talk about your in FTO when you were told that phrase.
Oh, yeah. So when I mentioned that I had the one investigator when I was training for investigations that was good, and the other that was not necessarily the best. The investigator that became a dear friend that I trained under the most, one of the things that he told me, because the hardest call that you ever have to make is to a victim to tell them that you can't prosecute the case. That is, I had no idea. How do you even make this phone call? And he said, well, let me tell you what I say. And I think this is just like so incredibly insightful. And he said, I tell people it's that I believe them. It's not that I don't believe them. I don't have enough evidence to put before a judge and a jury to make them believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that what happened was true. And then I kind of went on to expand it a little bit further. And it's that we don't want you to have to go through the trial and dragging things up if we don't know that there's going to be a conviction. Because it's very stressful. When you guys hear Kim's story, you will have some more insight into what that process looks like. And a couple of our other guests throughout the season, you'll hear kind of their stories of what it felt like to sit up on a stand and give those details. It's ultimately something that I became thankful that I was spared, is that I never had to do that. I never had to sit on a stand and tell the details of every single time I was sexually assaulted in front of my parents and in front of my boyfriend and my entire high school. So I think that, you know, we always have to balance that. And that was something that was very empowering, that he gave me those words so early on in my advocacy work of, I believe you, but I just don't have the evidence to make other people believe what you say over what someone else says.
Exactly. Well, you know, I've heard this story so many times and I've seen it brought to life in so many different ways, but each time you tell it, it just, I dissociate as your friend. And I'm like, oh, it's just Kara.
It's just Kara. I think
we do that all the time.
Oh, I know.
Holy crap, that actually happened? Like,
right.
You just have those moments where it's very surreal still, but the fact that you have created this life that impacts so many people after what you went through in those 18 hours is remarkable. It's nothing short of a miracle. And it's amazing because everybody can do that.
Yeah.
Anybody that is listening out there can do what we have done. You have the tools and the ability. It's tough. No one is going to sit here and tell you that, oh, it's easy and you just need to do X, Y, Z. Like, it is awfully tough and constant, but we can do it. We can do hard things. You're going to hear us talk about that constantly.
we can do hard things.
We might cry about it.
Yeah. And I want to also like piggyback on that and tell you that there are moments in your journey when you're going to be like, this isn't fair. It's not fair that I have to do this work. It's not fair. And it's not.
Right.
That is true. It is not fair. But ultimately, y'all, like, life isn't fair. Like, it's not about what's fair. And I think that fairness is an illusion. I think that if you hang your hat on that, you're going to end up disappointed time and time and time again. You kind of just have to be like, yeah, it's not fair. But if I want something to change, I have to change. If you want to change the outcome, you want to change the pattern, you have to break the pattern, you have to change the behavior. And so the fact of the matter is that there are so many ways to healing. There are so many paths to healing. Like, that's one of the things that I talk about. I mentioned that therapy was not accessible when I realized that, hey, maybe you were impacted by that big traumatic event that happened to you. And so I had to find means to heal. And those were very simple. I say simple because they felt very insignificant, but simple things that were free and accessible for me that had a long-term impact. And I kind of equate it to this idea of like healing. It's like a journey of 1,000 or 1,000,000 tiny steps. And it may feel slow and painful, and realistically it is, but you just have to take one step and then another step and another step. And sometimes you're going to fall on your ass and you're going to fail. But also, as long as you just keep getting back up and keep going, and you have other people alongside who can be like, get up, get out of the pit of despair. And like, we're going to walk together. You'll get there. And that's what we're here for. That is the purpose for us. And this podcast is just to join arms with you guys and to say, hey, I see you and I know how you feel and I know what you've been through. We can do hard things. We may want to wallow. We may not want to. And if you don't want to today, that's okay. Do it tomorrow.
Yes. No one is going to do this healing work for you, but we are here to help you. So with that, we cannot wait to bring you this season. I'm so looking forward to just sharing the immense amount of knowledge and experience that every single one of these guests have. And I'm just happy to be doing this with one of my best friends, and it's going to be really fun.
Yeah.
So let's model this for how it's going to look in general when we have these episodes. Kara, tell us more about where we can find you and some of the things that you have coming up.
Yes, I would love to. So I have a new podcast that's dropping now. You can listen to that. It's called Survivor's Guide to True Crime. Maybe you've heard of it. But I am also on social. I'm on TikTok and I am on Facebook and Instagram at Kara Robinson Chamberlain. I know it's a shit ton of letters. Sorry about it. I'm also on Twitter at KR_Chamberlain, if I remember correctly. I'm not really there a lot. You can find links to all of the things on my website, though, which is KaraRobinsonChamberlain.com. Things that I have coming up. There will be a book at some point soon. There is also a documentary, which I executive produced with Marwar Junction and Elizabeth Smart. And that is entitled Escaping Captivity, The Kara Robinson Story. It aired in 2021 on Oxygen. But best news ever, drumroll, is that there is a movie. It will be airing on Lifetime and it will be a double feature. We will have the details on the time and the exact date in the show notes, but it will be a double feature. Lifetime has actually licensed the rights to air my documentary. So back to back, you will have the Lifetime version of my movie, which I executive produced from beginning to end, from script to post-production, all the things, the movie. And then directly after the movie, you will be able to see the documentary, which I also executive produced, and it focuses heavily on minute by minute working through the story from all the different perspectives. And then, you know, I got a lot of things going on. Social media is the best place to follow along with all of the things and the antics of me and my non-emotional support dog and my husband and my crazy two boys and I and my life in an RV. So, you know, we got a lot going on.
I know. And so many big changes have happened even in the last years. Oh my gosh, I don't know how much I'm allowed to divulge, but Kara allowed me a little screening ahead of time. I love, like, obsessed with love movie production. So when she was getting those scripts, I'm like, I want to read all the edits and like, I love the behind the scenes stuff. And I watched the movie when you got that cut and was just blown away. Because I guess I still associated Lifetime with like the very cheesy, almost Hallmark kind of movies and stuff. And I watched this knowing that Kara had touched every single piece of it and had given her okay on it. And it was phenomenal. But I cannot wait to watch that live and to be able to see how many people it impacts and helps. But it was so well done. It was just really cool to watch. And it's still one of those like, I'm talking to her as I'm watching it. I'm like, what part are you at? Okay. How do I refer to she, you? I don't know.
We need to have a Patreon breakdown of us watching the movie. I think we live watch party. I know.
Yes, please. Yeah. That would be incredible.
I'm just saying. It's like, it's going to be so late Eastern time. I have to stay up till midnight. Oh my God. That's worth it. It's fine. I'll be fine. I just won't sleep. Yes, I was definitely involved from beginning to end with all of those projects. And that was something that when I realized what my purpose was behind sharing, because I always shared relatively openly. But when I decided to share with a purpose, which was to help people feel seen and heard and really to make a difference in that way, I realized that I was going to have to tell my story in a way that I was proud of. And so I reached out to my friend Elizabeth Smart, asked her, how should I start this? And she gave me the name of a production company that she worked with and that I went on to work with on both of these projects. And they have just been so phenomenal. And I think the funny thing is that I always seem to be surprised by the finished product, or like whenever I go to them and I'm like, hey, I really hate this part of the script. And they're like, okay, we'll change it. And I'm like, wait, oh. I just spent 2 days dreading this phone call. And you said, Okay, we'll change it. All right, because I'm an executive producer.
That, my friends, is the power of being an EP.
Yeah. I mean, which sometimes people are just EPs and name, but I wanted to be involved. And so that was made clear through the process. And, you know, I got to go up for the filming and there'll probably be some exclusive content of that over on the Patreon. And it's been an amazing process. And honestly, like I always knew I wanted to write a book. I always knew I wanted to do a documentary. A movie wasn't something that I was like, I definitely want to do it. But but I mean, you have a cool movie, a cool like movie angle, though. It, like you got a whole thing. It was just never something that I necessarily wanted to do. So when it kind of got put on the table, I went to my production company and they're like, yeah, I mean, if you want to do it, we'll do it, right. And it's I feel like it's probably insulting to them when I get these finished products. I'm like, I actually like it. They're like,
well, the best thing, you would text me or send me a voice memo like, oh, by the way, look at this. And I just send back voice memos of me screaming because I'm going to be cheerleading the entire way and really, really excited about all the things.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what we want to do for you guys, too. Like, that's the importance of, I feel like Kim was the first person that became like my survivor sister, like my trauma sister, where I was like, hey, so do you know about trauma hangovers? And she's like, oh, yeah, dumbass, I do. Like, you don't know about that? And I'm like, no, I don't. I'm just a baby. Like, please help me. But, you know, like just having someone that you can be like, hey, I just shared my story today and I feel like a bag of ass now. I feel like I got hit by a truck. And it's like, yeah, man, that's normal. Like, just having someone and having someone that can, you know, send you escape room memes of that you
that
can laugh.
That was one time.
Yeah, you know, having someone that understands your humor that you can make these dark humor jokes with and they don't look at you like, oh, my God, do you have brain damage? Like, are you OK? They're like, no, yeah, that's funny. That's who we are. That's who we are to you guys. And we hope that
welcome to the shit show.
We have jackets.
Yes, welcome to the club. We have jackets.
Yeah, welcome to the club. Buckle up because it's going to be a fun ride. We will always be here with our dark humor, but also most importantly, we will be showing up vulnerably, authentically, and we will be doing so in a way that empowers you to be the best version of yourself, that gives you course of action and tips and tricks for how to get through this thing called life, and also gives you ways to empower other people. So that's what we're here for. We're so thankful that you guys are part of our journey and that we get to be part of your journey. And we're looking forward to it, and we hope you love it and you love us.
Yes, we are so excited.
All right. So make sure to tune in next week. You will get to hear Kim's story, which I know many of you will resonate with. Her story is a little bit different. She actually had more interaction with the justice system and prosecution. And, you know, it has a happy little bit of a fairy tale ending in there, too, for those who might like that kind of thing. So
we should always remind you the one thing that we're going to ask is, of course, to like, rate, review, share this with anyone and everyone that you can think of. The more you include the name of the podcast or us on whether it's social media platforms, blogs, whatever it might be, that's the kind of stuff that helps us out. It's very different than what Kara and I are used to, because you'll hear me talk about it next week. I don't care if you remember my name or my face. I want you to remember my story. But when it comes to reaching more people, in the case of like a podcast such as this one, we do need your help in getting that out there and sharing. So please do that and check the show notes. We're always going to include resources in there as well. But it's been fun. Can't wait to have you back.
It's been real fun. See you next week.
Ba-dum-ba.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.